Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ron and Don Show on Blog Talk Radio.
Good morning and welcome to the Ron and Don Show. My name is Don Allen in Studio A, and over in Studio B is Miss Janelle Hehe. Good morning, Janelle. How are you?
Good morning. Doing pretty good.
Yeah, it's been one of those wild and crazy weeks with the COVID-19 going on, the virus, and everything shutting down. It's pretty freaky. I don't know at this point what we're going to do, what more my family's going to do to be prepared. It's pretty interesting. How's that affecting you, Janelle, and your family?
I'm just stocking up on things like everyone else here in Minnesota, just making sure if unfortunately there is a quarantine for a couple of weeks that I'm well prepared, and checking on my elderly parents, make sure they're okay. Just preparing for the worst. We're hoping for the best, basically.
So I just got done reading the book, The Extinction Files Pandemic, about 4 weeks ago by A.G. Riddle, and it's really, really scary and strange. Some of the things in there, like art imitating real life, I guess that's what they say, and some of the things that are going on right now, you know, with everybody, we actually thought they were to close the schools or to give a longer school break. You know, my wife's a professor at the University of Minnesota, and she is not to come back to class. Everything she does from this point on is on a computer, Zoom video conferencing, and things like that. And so they're taking precautionary steps to make sure that everybody's okay. So it's a pretty interesting thing. But we have a guest holding I'd like to get to right away, Senator Mark Coran, Senator, Minnesota. Representing the district, Senate District 32, which is in eastern Minnesota. We'll have him talk a little bit more about that. But Senator Mark Coran, welcome to the show. How are you this morning?
Good morning. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, well, we're glad to have you here this morning. And we'd just like to move right into it. Can you tell us a little bit? Some of your background. I know you're a St. Paul guy. We talked about that a couple of weeks ago.
Yeah.
And just kind of give us a little information about yourself before we move into some deeper and concerning questions.
Yeah, so Don, you're right. I was born and raised in St. Paul. I'm a frog pounder for anybody who knows where that is, just west of the Capitol. Raised my kids in the Midway area, and then in 2007, moved to the Chisago County area. So I currently represent Chisago counties and Isani counties. And then along with that, the interesting thing, none of us ever planned to be here, but my background lends really well to this role, serving as a senator, is that I spent just under 18 years at the Minnesota Department of Revenue, built the state's electronic tax filing payment solutions when they didn't exist. And so that provided a priceless education on government as a business model, you know, or its operating model and its outcomes and the cause and effects of those. And that was all prior to the year 2000. I also had a job in the real world, as I call it, owned a small business, worked at a lumber yard, I was computer operator for the Health East Hospitals, helped my wife manage her fast food restaurant. And then since 2000, I've been selling business process outsource solutions into government. Government outsources a lot of what it does, and from entire agencies into business processes like the MNLAR systems, those types of things. And again, that portion of my career has given me a priceless education on government and continually validates my understanding of it and why we see the performance that we see out of government. And I know we talked a little bit about that, and I'm sure we'll talk a little bit more about that today. so that's my background in a snapshot.
Okay, yeah, we will talk about the performance of government for sure. This 2020 legislative session, I've been watching very closely. I know that that a group of concerned African-American citizens went up there and pushed through this bill for hair discrimination. Have you seen any other type of bills, like maybe anything supporting the Minneapolis Urban League or places like that, flagship African-American agencies? And if you have, what has been the discussion?
That on the African-American, I think the one bill that's been continued or stayed out there is the African-American Family Preservation Act. I think that's, you know, that I think Rena's got that, or Representative Moran, and that's been there last year. In addition to last year, a couple bills that I carried that were significant to the African-American population was, interestingly enough, the Father Project, which is a great project, helping young men regain a significant role in their children's lives. In fact, it's the only organization, I believe, that supports men in that conversation, because we don't treat men equally in the division of children or the roles and responsibility of children, either through divorce or otherwise. And then the you mentioned hair, and you know, I think the Crown Act is being discussed. And then last year, it seems some people might look at it and say, well, this doesn't seem significant, but we actually removed an overburdening cosmetology board on hair braiding, some regulations on hair braiding. And
wow,
it's a wonderful opportunity. And I carried, I was the chief author on both of those bills for the last, for the last 3 years. And when it goes to eyelashes, hair braiding, all of those are great opportunities for our entrepreneurial people in the cities and out everywhere around the state. And we don't need an overburdensome regulatory environment where they've got to spend $20,000 to become licensed to braid hair. And so we removed those requirements and freed everybody to go out and be an entrepreneurs and run their own great businesses.
Okay. Wow, that's very interesting. You know, in our community, Senator Curran, and I just have to tell you this, and we've had Senator Eric Pratt on, we had Senator Roger Chamberlain. We look forward to having a couple more of senators from both sides of the aisle and state representatives. Ray Dean's coming up pretty soon here in about 2 or 3 weeks. But
sure,
when we get into these meetings in our community, our elected officials, or the officials that look like us at the state legislature, say that they tell the community the Republicans blocked it or the Republicans stopped it. And what I hear you telling me now is that you were the chief officer on a couple of bills and supported a few bills that are for, you know, everyone, but specifically focused and origined out of the African-American community in Minnesota. And for our listeners, the reason why I'm telling our listeners this is because it's important that we're well-read and we look at both sides of the aisle to find out who's doing what, because what we're being told is not necessarily true. Now, government performance. We've been looking at these articles coming out from the Star Tribune and different news channels on government performance, especially the Minnesota Department of Health and Human Services and their many overpayments and the things that are going on. And this might be a big question, but how do we rectify things like this? And you being a government business, someone with government business acumen, what was the problem in the first place? How could something $29 million in an overpayment happen when the government is supposed to be one of the strictest organizations or businesses, you know, period? How does that happen?
Hey Don, we'll cover the government operational effectiveness, and then let's circle back to the African American Family Preservation Act and the message from your elected officials. So, on the government efficiency, or I get into debates all the time. One, it's why I'm here. I've been a guy about government transparency and accountability just because of my background. What we see from government, people look at it and say, oh my God, it's broken. And I will argue vehemently that it is not broken. It's designed to produce the results we're currently seeing. And so when you have a business process that has no naturally available or natural market forces or corrective action built into it, How if you never have any naturally occurring corrective action built into a process in which you, it doesn't matter what it is, if you're never guided or you're never corrected, how would you ever know you're getting your job right? And it's not because we have bad people. It's because we have, it's a human nature process. And if you don't correct somebody, they're going to, their job will evolve into a very, very different outcomes or very different form in which we imagine it and what they're supposed to be doing. They are, the process detaches the agencies from the really, the service or the product or the regulatory role in which they play. Remember, in government, most have never worked in the industry in which they're regulating or overseeing. Most have never worked in the agency in multiple positions or multiple roles to understand what they do in a comprehensive manner. So when you remove those elements and then add into the public union structure, right, that structure and the world of political correctness to the nth degree, you get degraded performance from the moment people enter into that system. And the degraded performance moves you down a level and down another level and down another level. Now, in that environment, I've looked at it, you got to look at it this way. There's still, I would say, 10% of that workforce is crazily driven, entrepreneurial, making everything happen. You have 45% of that workforce that you could argue about what job they're doing. You know, do you deem it valuable or not? But they're putting in a solid day. Then there's another group that is there, not producing a whole lot. And when they don't produce a whole lot, there's no corrective action that washes that or washes that out, those employees out, or changes the behavior to move them to higher performing levels of performance.
I'm sorry. Go ahead. I'm sorry. I didn't mean to cut you off.
No,
go ahead.
So that's kind of the you know what we get, and so when you look at Menlars, and I love Menlars only because Menlars is what people understand. That was one element of government that you actually you didn't have a choice, but you have to interact with it, and it has a public exposed component to it. You knew what the motor vehicle licensing system did. And you knew its performance, how long it took, and you interacted with it. They rolled out a new system that cost hundreds of millions of dollars, didn't do half of the functionality or didn't include half of the functionality of the old system. And it took them over 10 years to do this. I liked the model because the only difference between Menlars and everything else is that it had that publicly exposed component. When Department of Human Services fails, people die prematurely, and our most elderly, our most vulnerable, and our children are not treated with the greatest level of care. That's the real challenge.
Yeah, and I would have to agree with that 100%. But so what I'm hearing you saying is that, you know, we have some challenges with this system that is not working correctly and that needs to be adjusted, because it sounds like within the construct, like you said, there's not a corrective mechanism to make these things not happen. But then again, the people that fail the system, that just come in and go home and are not part of that 10 or 11%, are not really doing what they need to do. Sorry for the background chatter. But with that said, Janelle, do you have a question for the senator?
Yes, I wanted to know if there were any bills specifically for African-American women.
So tracking the bills for African-American women, I have not seen any bills specific to that. In our world, I serve on – I just moved over to the Department of Health and Human Services, that subcommittee, and I serve on state government, commerce, and environment, and elderly and aging. I have not seen any come through that track specifically. And so you realize there are almost 5,000 bills that have been submitted this year in the Minnesota Senate between both bodies. I have not seen any specific to African-American women. Doesn't mean they don't exist. In the realm of the committees and rolling through the bills that are pushed through those committees, I haven't seen any. But, you know, the one piece that we spoke about, or Don, you mentioned a little bit earlier, the African-American Family Preservation Act, and one of those, that was one of those bills that was discussed at great length for the African-American community. And it really pulls into, or really, it's a great example of, I think, what's wrong is that during the there was the African-American African-American Heritage Council for the state agency. They ran a legislative update, and I think it was July. I, of course, attended it, and that was one of the bills, and I think, Don, you mentioned, when the legislators, your elected officials, are presenting it, they presented it as, oh, if only the Republicans would get out of the way, this would be a great, you know, this deal would be done. There's some information missing on that. One, the portion that kind of killed it last session was actually an agency, Department of Human Services, and their fiscal note, meaning the cost side of that bill and the agency's reluctance to provide information is what's killed that bill. The other piece to that is that bill really is comprised of a host of statutes that just reflects and kind of restates existing statute, meaning the State Department of Human Services, County Department of Human Services, they're not doing what they should be doing at the level we expect them. And a lot of it's around out-of-home placement for our children. And so this bill is a compromise, is a composition of existing statute. And the sad part is to restate the statute again and to tell the agency again that they're failing to perform will not move and will not change people's lives. A bill like that won't do it. What we have to do is get to, one, focus on the performance of the agencies, and it is critical, the work, the failure when it involves our kids. That's where we have to reimagine and transform government, and that's what we have to focus on. And unfortunately, those that presented that, and it was really disheartening to see, to participate. I love to educate. That's the greatest thing that we get to do. One is there's the mundane kind of the legislative process. But the other part is really understanding what are the greatest drivers of why we get what we get. And none of that dialogue occurs in anything I've seen in the meetings I've attended in Minneapolis, North Minneapolis, and St. Paul. That's kind of sad.
Okay. You just said a whole bunch of really good stuff. But let me try to figure out how to get this into a question rather than a comment. But so we look at MnDOT. MnDOT, according to the rules and the statutes, the laws, or whatever you want to call them on the book, for the last 25 years has not been in compliance when it pertains to minority ethnic business and women-owned business.
Sure.
You look at the Minnesota Department of Health, the Minnesota Department of Administration, Met Council. I mean, there's a host of Minnesota agencies that, like you said, are not doing what they need to do. And I'm looking at it from a Six Sigma point of view, making sure that agencies and people function and don't do more, but do what they're supposed to do in the first place. So with that said, the African American Preservation Act fell on its face last year, last session, and didn't move forward. This year, it seems like they have, and I've read it, they have the same stuff in there that they kind of had last year, which duplicates standing statutes that have been passed a while back. I guess my question is, are people not reading, or how do we solve this to get this? This is a very important bill for the African-American community, especially with the out-of-home placement of some minority ethnic kids. But go ahead.
I would argue, and don't take this wrong, but it's not a very important bill, because if it's already stating existing statutes, it means it's already law. right? And so
yes.
what all of those things do is when we talk about the corrective action when they get it wrong, and whether if they act outright or it's just the level of performance that is degraded over time. And what we have is a complete detachment from the decision-making process in the entire agency. When they're making – go back to the Minlars piece. It didn't work. It wasn't a technology problem. It was a business problem. They don't know the people who use their solution, deputy registrars and automobile dealerships. They interact with that system every day. They didn't even consult and never visited one of those facilities to understand how that business process works. They didn't capture how the business process works for even their own agency personnel who have to deal with errors and things that come out. And so when they go to build the system, they get it kind of right. And then what do they do next? Then they spend more resources fixing the errors or the omissions in which they left out from the last version, and then they do it again and again and again. That's what government does. They are so removed from their decision-making process that, you know, that they're not accountable to it. And so all of the things you've seen, Department of Human Services, the fraud, waste, abuse, overpayments, lack of oversight, not a single person has been terminated. That's what happens in the real world. You know, in the real world, it'll correct itself. If you lose sight of your product or your service or why you exist, the market will naturally correct itself. Bankruptcy is a corrective action. None of those things happen. And I think most citizens today would be disgusted to understand how little recourse you have when our government either acts out against you or gets it wrong. And when we talk about the out-of-home placement for children, it affects the African-American population significantly. And the decisions, and it's, believe me, it's happening all over the state. It really is. In Chisago, we've got kids that are being removed first, put into a home, and that's a pretty traumatic environment. And we've gotten close to many of those cases where they put them out there, even when they have a safe environment with a family member, some of them are being placed with other people. And so that the trauma on that child is significant. We have, I don't know if people understand this, but tiny little Chisago County, we have three kids that have been taken out, and they are placed in out-of-state homes for temporary foster care. And that cost today, when we remove a child, not the mental health crisis that we create or the trauma that we create for that child, but it's $11,000 average per month for an out-of-home placement, just the basic components of it. When we move somebody out of state, it's $25,000 to $30,000 a month that Minnesota taxpayers are paying. And you can't tell me that we don't have those facilities available in Minnesota. And so in those cases, they are detached from their process. I want those people to live and breathe in that front line of the business in which they perform. You know, Department of Human Services at the state level makes the policies. The county Department of Human Services actually implements those policies. Their hands are typically tied. The solutions or the technology solutions and the information sharing works as well as Minlars does. So it's horrible. It's horrible. And so then they're the ones who actually perform the work. Now, Hennepin County, Ramsey County, they're larger forms of government, so they operate pretty similar to a state-level government that, right or wrong, they are not held accountable to their decision-making process. And when it's money, it matters. But when it's somebody's life, our children, our vulnerable, and our elderly, we can't afford to do that. And so we need to make sure that they are held accountable and perform at the highest levels. And we're far from that today.
Okay. since we're I'm getting a lot of texts from some veterans who happen to be teachers in Minnesota, and I asked them to call in, but they want me to ask you that this question.
Yeah.
They're interested in changing the Minnesota Veterans Preference Act, Minnesota Statute 197.46, the Veterans Preference Act, removal forbidden right of mandamus. And the reason is, in Section D of that bill, which basically, let me give you some context. The teachers union went on strike, which means that a lot of teachers did not work. A lot of teachers chose to be with support the strike. While I supported some of the efforts within the strike, I, as a high school English teacher, did not strike. So I received via email, a letter saying that if the strike went on past April 9th, I would be terminated, laid off, actually. And that if the strike ended, I would be assigned based on my seniority to some school somewhere, somehow. Then I turned to the Veterans Preference Act, which has a clause in there that says, hey, you know, if you're a veteran, you can appeal this, because the only way that you can get fired or laid off from a job is by misconduct or bad behavior, and that's in the bill. But if you scroll and you don't read the whole bill, you have to read the whole thing, it has one sentence in the bill that says, nothing in this section shall be construed to apply to the position of teacher. So I guess my question is, how do you change these bills and policy? And who was the, I have to say, wingnut who decided in the Veterans Preference Act, because from what I understand, being a Chapter 31 veteran, going through my teacher training and the degree process, the VA always wants veterans to become teachers in Minnesota, and they make it very easy for you to attain, you know, the funding that you need to do that. But if something like this happens, a strike, and you get a letter of layoff, you have no recourse as a veteran or a teacher to go in and successfully fight something that you did not, you know, create. So I guess my question is, for this, before we move on to the rest of the questioning, how do you correct a sentence in a bill or a statute that focuses on one group, actually damns one group, and it is not equitable to anybody? I mean, how do we change that as average citizens that are reading this that get appalled?
John, in that one, I did see your Facebook post, and I thought today would be a great day to talk about it. So you'll find at the Capitol, right, there's 1,000 people working for everything you believe in. There's also 1,000 people working against everything you believe in. And the only way those voices become more powerful is because citizens don't show up themselves. And so in this particular case, I'm no idea who and how that part was carved out. Why a veteran carve out was not, or that preferential treatment was not provided for veteran teachers. We can make it really easy, and I can tell you the greatest way to find out who is backing that is what you and I'll get together. We'll drop a little bill that strikes that and removes the teacher exception to that, and then we'll find out who shows up to my office in opposition. Because I can tell you, those in opposition show up very quickly, and we do everything, right? At least when you hear everything, and we support our veterans vehemently. But you find a lot of different carve-outs, even in the public employment sector. MnDOT, I believe, doesn't acknowledge some of the veterans' preferences from a hiring perspective and recognition of years of service, which we offer to many other people entering into state government service. I think our veterans, to me, should be at the top level. So you and I will work together, and we'll draft the bill to remove that exception, and then we'll find out where any opposition would come from. So,
I'm so glad you said that, because people in our community, and this is why we have to get you out into the community to talk to these groups, these different groups of people, South Minneapolis, North Minneapolis, St. Paul, West, East, and West Side, because we're not hearing a lot of this stuff that needs to be citizen-driven, to be at the state capitol, to show up. And And I think it would be very important to get you and a couple other senators and state representatives that, you know, lean to your direction and see to your views, agree with them, to these forums and discuss this. This is a very important time. Now, I appreciate that because I was really depressed when I saw that because I had no recourse after I've already sent out all my letters, you know, basically complaining. And a guy from the state, Minnesota Department of Veteran Affairs, who was a teacher and left the teaching job because of that, basically said that, you know, it has to be changed. You know, he's cool doing what he's doing. He's not going to go lobby out there and get it changed. But
right.
It's affecting a lot of things that stop us from doing what we need to do.
Don, I've been showing up to many other places, and one of the things after that, the African American Legislative Update in North Minneapolis, I asked the same council, because it is a state agency, to hold another hearing, information session, listening forum, whatever we want to call it. Hold another one. I'd show up. I got Majority Leader Gazelka committed wherever I can arrange a meeting. He's going to show up, and really, it's about a dialogue. I'm a common sense guy. And that's what it's about. Do people? I think the part where you will be disheartened is when you find out that the government today in Minnesota is running in without direction from the or without consideration to the legislative body, and certainly it can supersede the executive body as well. It has an ecosystem that functions. It knows we're all temporary, and more today than ever, it's become more powerful, and its lack of consideration for the legislative body. We're not special, Don. We were your neighbor before we were elected, and we're your neighbor after we were elected. But you'd be shocked at how many informational requests, just basic things that we put into the state agencies, and they utterly refuse to respond to us. At all.
Okay.
And we're talking about public data.
Yeah. It's very interesting that you say that. Before I move on, our call-in number is 347-426-3904. Again, that number is 347-426-3904. This is very interesting, and I have to tell our listeners because they expect the truth here. I've reached out to the Council of Minnesota for Minnesotans of African Heritage and its executive director, Justin Terrell, on several occasions. If the African American community remembers, when Dr. Lewis Porter was the executive director of the council, he had to return over $90,000 in funding back to the state, and his excuse was he didn't find any programs or systems within the Black Minnesota population that was deserving of these funds. Today we have Justin Terrell in that position who swings one direction politically, and when asked to do things to better the lives and the information of people in the African American community, he usually declines. And I don't understand that at all. And this is not an attack on him personally. It's more an attack on a one-sided political agency that has not done the best in information distributing for Minnesota's Black community. So I'm going to reach out to him again, Senator Curran, and have a little ear ringing with him and see if he's would make an opening to do this, because he does have the funding. He has that big room down there in the First Bank building on the first floor where there's been many conferences before, and try to open up a dialogue diplomatically and cordially with him to see what's going on and just to see if he is even interested. We have a caller. Stand by. Let's see. Caller. Caller, you're live on the air. Do you have a question for the Senator, Janelle, or myself? Okay. Looks like
I don't know if you're talking to me. Or...
Go ahead, the caller? Okay.
No, you go ahead, Janelle.
I just heard a lot of talking, so I don't know what talking at once. Do we have a caller?
No, we do not.
Okay, I got a little delay there. Sorry. I was going to have, when we do take calls, Khalees, one of the individuals who helped create that bill for the Family African American Preservation Act, possibly going to be calling in. But I just wanted to know, like, when you said, back to that, when you said that the bill is just a highlight of existing statutes, is there already a statute that specifically protects African American families in Minnesota? Because I'm not aware of it. I just wanted to know if there was.
I don't know that there's a bill specifically protecting, as it protects all citizens. But the in that particular bill, I believe the majority of it is existing statute or attempting to pull out from the Department of Human Services and all the other agencies that are entwined in the bill, that the agencies perform at a different level and for all communities. But the one meeting, I think, is the only time I heard, I think, Senator Hayden talk about it. It's like, this bill is unnecessary if the state agencies would just do their jobs. And I believe that to be true. In most cases, a bill in itself, if the agencies aren't performing and meeting what you need today, we've got to put a tremendous amount of pressure on the county board, because the county is the most important piece in that daily interaction. We're doing everything we can at the state level, Department of Human Services. We have to get them out in the field. We have to teach them what their job is, and we have to make sure that they understand what the impact is to the entire family.
Yes.
Right? We've got challenges.
That is a highlight of the bill. It says to provide like cultural competency training for a child protection workforce. Is there already a program like that in place right now that does that?
I believe, if not in statute, the policies are certainly there today, both at the Department of Human Services and the county. But
it's not being done, though. But it's not being
correct.
Done.
It's not being done. It's not being done.
But
and then
that's
like,
part of the bill. Why can't the bill get passed? Why are they? This is what bothers me about these bills. And it's a very important bill when 60% of African American families, their children get displaced. That's highly disproportionate to the population of Minnesota. It's ridiculous. So it is
only
alarming. And the bill the bill needs to be specifically for African Americans, since we're specifically affected. I don't think people of color or any other group should even be considered in this bill. It's just Native and African American, obviously. But why is it that every time there's something like this presented, it's like, oh, these statutes already exist and the agencies aren't doing their job? That's really irrelevant to me. That's like more of a grammatical thing. It's not the bill to me. Just it should have been passed. I don't understand why it wasn't passed. I don't see how that's relevant to anything. Their existing statutes, if they're not being enforced, and I don't see an African American Preservation Act that already exists. I just see a one in general for a general population. But I think that we should be a protected class since we're obviously being targeted. But that's just my opinion.
I think the bill should
have got passed.
Well, the key that stopped that bill was the Department of Human Services. And the fiscal note, the financial component that they put to it, which was not believable. I think Senator Hayden would tell you that one. But I agree with you that those things exist. And I agree completely that the out-of-home placement has affected the Native American population, African American population, and more significantly based on the numbers. And when you look at the socioeconomic status of those that it impacts, it's happening across the board. It's going tenfold across the state in the last, probably the last 3 years. There's been a little dip last year, but that doesn't diminish. You know, we almost went tenfold in increase in out-home placement. What changed besides the policies in which they chose to implement? And it's across the board. You go up to Beltrami County in the Native American, there's only 7,500 tribe members. 1,000 kids a year are removed from out-of-home placement or moved into out-of-home placement. 1,000 kids a year. And that's the same thing in the African-American population. What, again, a bill will not drive or change their behavior. it's getting the agency to drive and actually do their job. So all of the things that we talk about, is it calling, does the African American Family Preservation Act call them out specifically for the African American population and Native American? Yes, but it's not going to create any new statutory requirement that they shouldn't already be following. That's my point. And I think that's the part where you'd be greatly disheartened, not just on the out-of-home placement, but in every aspect of the government and our ability to get it to do its job. One, it starts here at the governor's level. I have been here. I know this role uniquely. From how do we move this machine, or what we have to start moving that and get accountability, so you as a citizen feel good about what you get. And I can't tell you many people that feel good today. When it touches our kids, you know, those types of policies will cause rational people to do irrational things. You couldn't do anything worse to a parent, take their kid away, period. Doesn't matter who you are. That's the part that we've got to make sure that people understand. Our governor needs to do something. And I can tell you, he has absolutely no interest in having this conversation. I have tried many, many times to get a meeting with this governor, and he won't take a meeting with a sitting state senator. The agencies don't have any regard for us. If they have that little regard for us, I'm not sure they have any regard for our citizens. And that's that, Janelle, that's the big piece that we're driving. The African American Family Preservation Act, Department of Human Services, killed that bill. If they decide they don't want that bill to move forward, the governor would never sign it, no matter what he says. And so that's my point. My point is to a bill like that, and any bill we talk about, it could be the most critical in addressing a tragedy that occurs. None of that's going to do what it's supposed to do until government starts to function. And we're a long ways away from that.
Okay. Janelle, do you have something else? Go ahead.
No, I don't. Nope.
Okay.
Janelle, I do. I appreciate it because I appreciate it's what we should be talking about, and really the nuts and bolts of how can you be the most valuable as a citizen. To hope a bill is going to do it. One, it's important, right? It's structural reform, and those things are important. But the other more important piece is how do we get them to do exactly what we want them to do? And that's what the bill is supposed to do.
Yep. What was your recommendation? What would you encourage people who want to get this act passed? Like, what are the steps?
I think the continued steps of the pressure, right, putting pressure on, finding out what those issues are at the Department of Human Services and why they are reluctant to agree or to help shepherd that through, because they play an equal role. If the department decides they don't want to do it, they have the greatest amount of influence on the governor to shut that down. The other piece is what's important is I think people have to put a lot of pressure on the governor and county commissioners, because this is a twofold challenge. The county DHS are the ones who actually do that job, and yet their policies are driven by the State Department of Human Services. Our governor needs to start a process to reimagine how we deliver government. We have to teach them and to get just take one that's more easily defined. In Department of Human Services, they oversee group homes, PCA services, direct DSPs, direct service providers, and then certified nurses. I want everybody in the Department of Human Services to be trained and certified as a CNA, DSP, or a PCA. I want all of them working it from a management perspective down. Don mentioned a little bit about Six Sigma. That applies logic to this business process because it includes accountability. This, we have to build in that accountability that doesn't naturally occur. We've got to get their managers working the front lines within an agency. And in Department of Human Services, it's a complicated world. Department of Human Services needs to work in the front lines of their staff at the state level. Department of Human Services state level actually needs to work and do the job in the county. Because if they're going to make rules and policies and they're actually going to implement and live them themselves, then you give them a little bit more credibility, right? Until they do that, they'll never have any attachment to the decision-making process and the outcomes of their decisions. And we have to start that. The other piece, it goes even further in the world of complicated Department of Human Services, is that most of the services are delivered by the private sector, nursing homes, group homes, and a whole host of other businesses. I want them actually working in that business. I want them working in a nursing home for 1 week every 6 months to understand the policies and their impact on our resources. We will have more finite resources in the future, and so we need to make sure that those resources go to our highest priorities. If we don't create that entire attachment to why they exist, it's going to be very difficult for anything to drive to modify their behavior, one, to do what we want, and then two, to do the work we want at the level that we expect them so you feel good about the value you get in government. And it's a simplistic view. But it's kind of – it's the same thing at Disney World. If you follow ever Disney, Disney trains corporate institutions to implement these things. I have worked with Disney. They're ready and waiting to go to do a pilot on some agencies. We want to instill and implement a pilot. Human Services is the first one I want to do because it touches lives. And we want to do a pilot. And I've proposed that to the governor a dozen times, and they show no interest. And I find it interesting that – you know, he speaks a lot, but his actions don't match his words.
Okay.
But that would be my point.
I agree 100%. We have a caller. Producers tell us that this is M from his palatial estate in South Minneapolis. M, welcome to the show. What's your question or comment?
Oh, I have just a couple of questions. Thanks for taking my call today. I just want to, you know, commend this this conversation as a longtime worker in the child protection area, supervisor with Hennepin. Your guest really has, really has done a lot of study and really knows that DHS, the states, the powers that be, these are the ones that have the inertia. And Janelle is also right, too. We have these laws, we have all these things in place, but they don't follow them. So how do we get them to do what they say they're going to do? And so, in my humble opinion, having been in the child protection area for 25 years as a supervisor, what I think could be a positive thing is to tell the community what to do when you get that knock on that door by child protection, or when you get that call from child protection, what do you do? And what seems to happen is once that call comes in, the people that are being accused of abusing their son, if there's drugs involved, they don't want to tell their family this. They don't want to call their aunt or grandma and say, oh, grandma, they're getting ready to take my kids. I've been caught up in this crack thing. They don't want to tell them that. So they don't even get the attention that there's a case going on so they can intervene right away. And what they need to do when they get that knock on the door is call your resources, call your parents, call your relatives, and if they drag you into court, bring those people with you to court and tell that judge that, look, I'm the grandfather, and I will take my grandson home from this court right now, okay? We will get this process started. We're not going to let the wheel turn the other way. We're going to let this wheel turn our way. And I think that's what's really missing, that the community doesn't know what they're up against. And when they get caught in it, all of a sudden you're in court and this thing goes on. And the longer you're in it, it's like you're in quicksand. The more you sink down, and the harder it is for you to get out. But I think, you know, your guest made some excellent points that, you know, DHS, we've seen their ineptness. You know, as Nels pointed out, we've seen their ineptness. I mean, in funding and the way they handle and misuse all this millions of dollars, it would be cheaper if you have a family in child protection and they're talking and threatening to take their kids out. It would be cheaper to fly those grandparents. You could give those grandparents or relatives gas money, and they would drive up here to get those kids and take care of them. It would be way cheaper than sending them all across the country and getting all this litigation and all of this. But it's a practical type of solution that, you know, there's so many things involved. There's when kids go in placement, there's dollars involved. The county gets dollars for it. There are federal dollars involved for putting kids in placement. I know it sounds crazy, but you have to be able to unwound this ball, first of all, so we can understand what we're up against. But I really just wanted to commend your guest because I think he's really, really on the right track, and I hope that, you know, if he can get the community involved too. I mean, I think that's, you know, maybe we could tip the scales that way.
All right. Thank you for your call, Mr. Ian. We always appreciate you calling. We have another caller. Caller, 4188, you're live on the air with Ron and Don Show with our special guest, Senator Mark Horan. What's your question for the senator?
Well, I've been listening, and no disrespect to the Senator Horan, but it just seems like it's all excuses. You know, this is why this doesn't work, and this is why that doesn't work, and it's human nature. And, you know, we look back over the last decade plus at the MnDOT fiasco and MnLARS and human services. I mean, we're talking hundreds of millions of dollars almost on an annual basis, just is tossed in a toilet. And we get no results. You know, the 10 years that MnLARS thing went on, and before anything significant happened. So, I mean, we're talking about a lack of being able to get bills passed and getting support for them and everything, but how can we expect anything like that to happen when we got hundreds of millions of dollars just disappearing? I don't know that anybody's even been fired over all that fiasco at Human Services. You know, somebody's got to be responsible for all the money disappearing. Somebody had to sign something. And it just keeps going on and on. I mean, it's just the dysfunction is unbelievable. Lack of accountability is unbelievable. It's doesn't make me too hopeful.
Okay. Sir, thank you for your comments. They're well taken. And I have to say I agree with you 100% on that. Again, thank you for the call. Make sure you keep listening. Senator Horan, with that said, we have two callers, basically the same position, kind of understanding and agreeing or disagreeing with you.
I think they're both agreeing with me. So.
Yeah, they are. They are basically, yes, yes. And so let's pinpoint something in the black community. Justin Terrell is actually watching this via Facebook Live. His name just popped up, and he's executive director of the Council or the Heritage, whatever they call themselves. They used to be the Council on Black Minnesotans. I don't know why they changed their name in the first place. But anyway, how do we look at this African American Preservation Act, this bill, and work it through the system and trim the fat, for lack of a better expression, and make sure that this bill, what it seems to me, I read the bill and I saw the comparisons of the stuff, like the education stuff. You have, respectfully, Justice Alan Page and the president of the Minneapolis or Minnesota Fed wanting to make education a civil right. And some of their wording is already in Minnesota Statutes 119A and 120A. So I don't expect this to fly anywhere, and it's not going to hurt anybody. Again, we have to make education do what they're supposed to do, follow those rules, those statutes. In the case of the African American Preservation Act, is there a way that this bill can be retooled in a way to force the hand of the agencies to do what they need to do to take corrective action when a formula comes up that says this is wrong or this is not beneficial to this particular child? Senator Rand, what should we be doing as a community right now in the last 6 minutes of the show?
I think on that one, Don, on the African American Family Preservation, I don't know what the DHS opposition to it was. The last I had heard is the opposition was a massive fiscal note, meaning it was going to cost millions and millions of dollars to implement this, and that just frankly can't be true because the reality is it's about doing your job, right? And so I don't know. I think getting that information. So I'm not sure who is the chief author in the Senate. I don't know if that's Hayden or not. But to find out, Rena probably can get you the information on that, Rena Moran, and what the opposition was. Does she speak to you, Don?
Oh, no. She called. I'm a hothead. So, yeah. But anyway, go ahead.
Oh, okay. Well, no, the So to find out what that opposition is and then to find out the elements, but to craft it to the point where that's the part where you can't create false hopes, is that to craft it in a manner that is actually going to cause them to do their job. That's the most challenging part. And again, that's what I deal with every day, to build in the accountability and the reluctance, the vast majority of accountability. When you look at the most powerful opportunity here, it's really the governor. The governor is the one that decides the platform that will be implemented, what is done or what the focus is across the state. And so he's, and again, that's why I've reached out to him. It's the most bipartisan thing we can do is to get our, we can argue about the statute, right? Whatever it is. But dang it, if they're in place today, we can agree that the most bipartisan thing we can do is to make sure that we operate and execute on that statute, on the Health and Human Services, which is vital to lives, to the roads that we drive on. That's the most bipartisan thing we can do. I also talk to the front lines with the AFSCME and the MAPE front line, you know, the front lines of the people who deliver our services. They are the experts and they're good people. But most of them feel so detached from the job because they know they have no recourse. They have no communication channel to share what they find on their jobs. And we need to be able to bring the management teams and attach them, put them shoulder to shoulder, working with the staff and actually doing the job and understanding what their value is in that life cycle and why they exist. They're screaming for more information. They're screaming to be more valued. It's not just a paycheck. And so they want to do that. So I think we have everybody online. The other thing that does is that by getting the attachment to making sure their jobs are higher value, and frankly, I'd like to have more or better paid state employees, but I certainly would like fewer of them, and to get into a position where we could also foster and put incentives in to create that higher level, to foster the higher levels of productivity. When you talk down about the Six Sigma, those are structural components that make you focus on your job. We need to implement those and force them upon the process. But the things that drive the lower levels of performance are human nature and the lack of being able to incentivize, either through compensation or any other way, to incentivize higher level performance. It just doesn't exist in the business model that the way government's formed today. So I know it's really complicated. I think the education part about where you start and continue to put pressure. I think on Mr. M, when he spoke about getting the community involved, knowing how this process works will help identify the agencies and the county commissioners and the pressure you need to put on them as they try to drive reform that has to happen at every layer of government that we have today. And I told you, I promise I've committed. I've reached out to Justin Terrell to try and have some information sessions available. He wasn't interested in doing that for anybody in a conservative nature or a common sense view. So we're going to go out and schedule those and have them on our own. So,
yes,
and we will. We'll be available wherever we need to be.
Okay, all right. With that said, we'd like to thank you. We've kept you for the majority of the hour for this great interview, this informational interview, and it will be posted. It goes right into podcast with the same link if anybody wants to share it or listen to it again. In closing, Senator Curran, again, thank you for being here with us. I know both Janelle and I are very happy. Are any last words? Well, let me ask you this. Are you up for reelection this year?
I am in 2020, as is all the body is in 2020, and we're also up again in 2022 after redistricting. Yes.
Okay. Well, you have our 100% support here, and we thank you for this interview. And we're going to bring you back on in a few weeks to get another update after the session closed to kind of find out what happened, what went on. And next week, I think we're going to have Kalis Houston on from the African American Preservation Act. And I really want to hear her position and her point of view and find out what kind of information that she's been given. And maybe we could play some clips from this for her. Again, thank you. I appreciate it. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Don. Thank you, Janelle, and have a wonderful day.
Thank you. You too.
All right. Bye-bye.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
So, Janelle, what do you think about everything that Senator Curran said about this bill? I mean, we have about 1 minute. We have under 30 seconds, but we can keep going. What do you think about what he said?
I think he did a great job at highlighting the challenges of the bill as far as Human Services Department blocking it and their incentive to block it. So I think that's really good information, and we can go from there to try to build a defense against that and move forward.
And next week we have you're arranging to get Ms. Kayla Houston on the air with us, correct?
Yes, she has agreed, so it is official. So we'll be writing up a post on that soon to highlight that show. I'm really excited to have her on.
Yes, I think we've had her on before, and it would be really great to get an update and find out a lot of misinformation out there in the community. And I never knew that it was DHS that was blocking this bill, because I've been told, and I saw on some Facebook posts and some meetings, that it was Republicans. And it seems that that's not the case. And so
right.
We need to unleash this.
Too.
Yeah, and then we need to, like, maybe get someone from DHS on the air with us next Saturday with Kalis to kind of let's myth bust this and see that what we can do to get this thing going, because the Council on Black Minnesotans of African Heritage is not doing what they need to do right now. And it's obvious, because if a Republican like Mark Curran, Senator Mark Curran, is asking us or asking the council to hold forums so that he and his counterparts can let the black community know exactly what's happening, and Justin Terrell is saying no, that becomes a problem for me, a huge problem.
Yeah.
Again, we don't really have a legislative agenda. And the last $200 million legislative agenda that we had back in the early 2000s, well, about 5 years ago, was from the executive director of the Council on Black Minnesotans, Edward McDonald. And when he submitted it, Senators Moran and Carolyn Lane both wrote bills to make him re-interview for his job, and they never hired him back. So this is not good. This is something that we must check into, and I would ask all our listeners to reach out to Justin Terrell and tell him to get on the stick and start having these forums with Senator Curran and the other side of the aisle, because it seems like, you know, the side of the aisle that looks like us is not doing a whole lot. Any other closing words, Janelle?
No, that's
the right. We're gonna let James Brown take it away with us. Thanks for listening to the Ron and Don Show with myself, Don, and Janelle. We'll be back next week.